Stephen Key is a successful inventor who has licensed his ideas for over 25 years. Several of his products have been endorsed by celebrities such as Michael Jordan and Alex Trebek, and sold in retailing giants such as Walmart, Walgreens, and Disney stores and theme parks worldwide. Stephen Key will be interviewing Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple Computers. Steve, or Woz as he prefers to be called, asked, "What if you combine computer circuitry with a regular typewriter keyboard and a video screen? The result? The first true personal computer, the Apple One, a widely affordable machine that anyone could understand and figure out how to use." For his achievements at Apple Computer, Steve was awarded the National Medal of Technology by the President of the United States in 1985, the highest honor bestowed on America's leading innovators. In 2000, Steve was inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame and was awarded the prestigious Heinz Award for Technology, the Economy, and Employment for single-handedly designing the first personal computer and then redirecting his lifelong passion for mathematics and electronics towards lighting the fires of excitement for education and grade school students and their teachers. After inventing the Apple I computer and its successor, the Apple II, Steve then left the corporate fast track for a life devoted to his family, philanthropy, and teaching. Here is successful inventor Stephen Key and his guest, the inventor of the personal computer, Steve Wozniak.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for joining us today. And our listeners and readers are going to be very excited about this, some of the questions we're going to ask, because I just got done reading your book, I Woz, and I found it very, very fascinating, especially at the early days. And the first question I have, Steve, for you is, looking back after all these years with the club that you had joined, Homebrew Computer Club, it seemed like there was an atmosphere of openness and that ideas were exchanged very freely. Did you ever have
any... Matter of fact, the club wasn't really started like to be a technical club as much as to be a social club and talk about the incredible advances for humanity that these computers were going to bring once we had our own. You know, the changes in our life, how we live it, and the changes in how much we'd be able to get done and learn. And I was more inspired by that. And I was just like most of the people. We were young people. We didn't have, well, we were young to old, actually. A lot of academics that came out that were Stanford professors would come down to the club. Some of them had technical skills and started making little companies to make boards they could sell, you know, out of their own homes. It was just an amazing, amazing thing. It wasn't the rich CEO types at all there. You know, there was almost nobody there had any money, or we could have, you know, had nice equipment at our disposal. We were all the people who couldn't even afford a computer and didn't like the fact our companies could afford one, but it wasn't ours.
Did anybody, including yourself, have any fears about sharing your ideas at that time?
Everyone got up, and the whole purpose of the club was almost the entire purpose was to help others who needed help. And we would have a large period of the meeting was called the mapping period. Some people would stand up and talk about interesting prod things that were coming up in the industry, just random general communication, you know, a certain part, a new microprocessor, a computer company announcing something. Other people would stand up and say, well, I've got some extra parts of this type, and if anyone needs them here, come see me and I'll give them to you. And some people would say, I have a certain weird machine, weird type of teletype, and the belt is slipping. Can anyone help me with this problem? In the second half of the meeting, it was your job to find the people to meet up with that interested you or that you could help or they could help you.
Wow. You know, that's so different. And today, some of the inventors groups that when they get together, the inventors seem to be so private and they try to keep their ideas to themselves. So we find this extremely amazing that at that period.
We were sharing everything. I mean, my computer designs, I just put them on paper and passed them out. No copyright notices or anything. But remember, the value of an industry wasn't obvious. Nobody of us had been businessmen. Nobody, you know, was looking into millions of dollars. So basically it was really to help these other people build a computer very cheaply so they could help lead the revolution.
I see. Thank you.
And that was my own intent. There were a lot of companies that sprung out of our club, and yeah, the companies did the things companies do to keep things sort of private, but no, they showed what they had even before it was out. And, you know, it wasn't like today's companies that have, you know, all sorts of departments, legal departments and public relations departments and, you know, that and just general executives. Sure. No, nobody can know what we're doing until we formally announce it. It was just the opposite.
Do you think that could exist today, Steve, that type of openness? Or was it just a period
of time?
At the time,
I felt like, what's anybody going to learn? They see somebody doing something good. I was so young and naive, I didn't even think that engineers would ever copy somebody else's work. You know, after we started Apple, I was sort of shocked. I found that people would copy it outright with a Xerox machine for the sake of money. I honestly, to God, thought that back in those days, engineers were just the most perfect, pure people in the world that could never do anything but use their design skills, the things they'd been taught through their life and in college and in courses. So my answer then would have been different than now. And now, now, you know, some things maybe it is better to keep them closed for reasons, legal reasons. How we have set up our laws and especially our business laws, business regulations, taxation systems, sometimes it's just better to, you know, you need a certain amount of protection. It's like saying, do you want to leave your home unlocked?
Sure. No,
well,
absolutely.
In some cases, it doesn't matter. In some cases, I might be working on some engineering ideas that, so what? So what if I tell other people? These are ideas that, you know, I thought of a way to combine something a certain way. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm not going to go ahead and make a product and make a lot of money off of it. You know, you can be smart sometimes. Sometimes in a company, everything is kept secret when the secrets couldn't possibly help a competitor or somebody cost you money or put you out of business or something. But everything's got to be so secretive. I think we're overboard in the wrong direction.
I would agree. Yes, I would agree.
We don't use our minds and say, this much should be protected, and here's why. And these other things really kind of don't matter. But on the other hand, look at Apple Computer. We used to have so many slips, rumors about new products, and it very much hurt the introduction and the sales to build up a big following. The sort of following Apple has depends a lot, actually, on secrecy.
I understand.
Nobody can talk about anything they're doing, even to the other groups in the company, you know, just aren't allowed to know what they're doing. I recently was out at Honda in Columbus, Ohio, and any group there didn't know what the new features of the next new Honda was going. They knew that one was being worked on in one of the buildings, but they weren't, never, ever saw it or got close enough to have any details. And
wow.
So it's the same sort of thing. You just pretty much, in business, you know, having a big surprise, when you have something that changes every year or two, its form and its features, and it's so important an aspect to your sales, then you can't have the secrets leaking out early.
Exactly. You know, Steve, a lot of inventors that we work with, including myself at times, are, you know, we're fairly private and, you know, fairly shy. We don't really have a lot of sales experience. And looking back over everything that's happened to you, is there anything that you could add to that, to where it would help, you know, inventors bring their products to market if they put the right teams together?
I wish I could add to it, but I was so partial to the engineering side of things that I didn't form really good understanding of the more business side of things, marketing side. I mean, I have a lot of awareness as to what a marketing person's going to say and think because I've been around them for so long, but it's how do you say to get that into an engineer whose number one priority is creating a device that they want to create, especially the inventor type. The inventor type has a weird idea that's different than somebody else's and wants to prove to themselves as much as anything. And and to them, the importance isn't even the money, the marketing. Although you run to a lot of young people these days and they want to be entrepreneurs and they have an idea, but the idea is on paper. It's not a finished product. When we started Apple, we had a finished product. We had a great product to start with. We didn't have to go out and turn some ideas into a product.
Okay.
So a lot of these people think, well, we've got some ideas. Where do we take them from here? Sometimes it's just businessmen, and they need to find some technical people. And one of the most important things I learned in the early days of Apple was we succeeded where a lot of other little startups building hobby computers failed because they didn't have a complete team of good people. And we had good people in every one of the categories that we needed them in. You know, be it accounting, be it president and running things in the operations, marketing, engineering, you know, and general drive. We had very good people that we hired.
Very good.
And unfortunately, it does take money.
Yes,
you know,
it does.
Or it takes money or luck.
Takes, I think, a lot of both.
But if you have very good communication skills, then you can convince people who have the other skills and the money to join you. even to join you, you know, almost a lot of stuff for gratis.
Because sometimes when we talk to inventors, we mention to them maybe they should find someone that can complement their skills. And if they're not great at selling, maybe they need to partner up with someone that has some good sell skills that can help them get out there and maybe show the product and maybe find those people that have some financing.
Yes, although usually the person who wants to start a company and be an entrepreneur these days is more business-oriented and has more sales skills, and they need to find the technical people. Now, how do you find them? And I just suggest, you know, hey, if you're young and you're in school right now, you're in some university, you know, go around, try to find out, you know, who in that university kind of, you know, does lots of amazing things,
okay,
you know, and all on their own and doesn't need a ton of people around them help, and they only do one little tiny narrow amazing thing. You see, most professors just have a category that they're very good at, one tiny slim category, but you got to find the broad person who, you know, builds microprocessors and hooks sensors up and has, you know, great display work, code himself as well as the hardware. You know, go around, ask the right questions, find that type of person, get them interested in what you're doing. Sometimes the deep engineering type, even inventor type, is narrow-minded. They see their own way. They want to do their thing. It's very difficult to talk them into something that they're not already interested in.
I understand.
You know, getting the interest in the right person is the best place to start. So if it's phony interest, boy, you're going to have a tough time.
Well, you know, in your book, Steve, you talk about taking one step at a time. And looking back through your career, it seems like you were extremely hands-on, that you were building things all the time, and it built that vast knowledge of a lot of different things. How is that important to an inventor, such as being patient and taking the necessary steps at one step at a time? Could you talk a little bit about that and how it's affected your life?
Yeah, typically an inventor is like really driven by curiosity and a real practical sense. They talk about theoretical sciences and practical sciences, and the inventor is always the practical type. And they want to get an idea, but somehow have a lab they can run into and turn it in, wire some parts together, write some code, and turn it into a real demonstration. Yeah, this might work. Now, that's a starting point. Now you've got to have the enthusiasm to get other people enthused as well.
Okay. Steve, I have one more question for you here, and this is one that every inventor can relate to. How did you find the courage and the confidence to follow your dreams, especially when you were at HP and you were going to start Apple? A lot of inventors, even myself, were not quite sure of the future. So how did you find your voice? How did you find that courage?
Well, for me, my future was designing products that would aid me for the rest of my life, and it was so easy. You couldn't fail. I didn't have to have any courage to do it. Just had to, you know, make the time when I was at home and when I had the time, and it was really easy. And it was the fun thing for me anyway, so I enjoyed it. The difficult part of starting Apple came about because I loved Hewlett-Packard. I was purely engineering-oriented. I wanted to work at Hewlett-Packard for the rest of my life. And leaving Hewlett-Packard to start Apple was a difficult decision. And I went inside, and I wasn't going to ever be in my life influenced by the money alone, but rather by who I am and what my desires in life were. And I wanted to be an engineer for life at Hewlett-Packard, but I also wanted to create computers and software for people. So I reasoned somewhat incorrectly that I could still design computers and write software at home as I had been doing and have that fun part of my life still. So at first I turned down doing Apple, but the end result is I really wanted to create computers that other people got to use and learn from, and Apple really provided that route. Something you put it out, and that's going to make you money, which helps you design even more things for them. So, you know, it magnifies your worth as an engineer.
Is there anything you can say, Steve, that help other inventors that when they're at that crossroads to believe in themselves or to find the courage to go forward? Because sometimes it's hard to jump off and try something new.
Dobbs and I were very normal thinking people. We just used common sense. And one of the things was I was very shy, but Steve was very outward. And that was a great combination because my shyness brought me into being very different and building products that hadn't been built before. And Steve's outwardness helped sell it to the world and anything that needed doing. You know, he went out and found a way. You know, we started the company with no money. We didn't have any bank accounts. We didn't have any cars that we owned. I'm thankful that Hewlett-Packard's credit union for a TV after my TV got stolen, you know, to build stuff. And what we did was we arranged the one of the best stories that people can read when they're young and don't have money and don't know the way. How can I do it with nothing? Is to read about how with the Apple One, we got the parts on 30 days credit, built the computers in 10 days, and then got paid cash on delivery at the store. And we drove them in our own cars to do this. And that was the only way we could have financed it. We couldn't have possibly put up the money to even build the Apple Ones.
Yeah, it's amazing. Truly amazing.
And, you know, just little ideas. We didn't start the company as a computer company. We started to build PC boards for $20, sell them for $40 that would shorten the time it takes somebody in the club to build my computer. And that was a simple, simple, tiny little start, you know. And, you know, but it was in line with the amount of money we had at the time. So, okay. You know, you're generally a person who's starting a company is thinking, how much money do I need to do what needs to be done? Well, another way to look at it is with the money you have, what can you do as a start?
You know, you still seem very passionate. It's amazing. I've always tell everybody, whatever that passion is, find it and stay with it. And it's your story is truly amazing. And I just want to thank you for sharing with us today and with our readers and listeners, Steve.
That's a really good comment. I'm glad to hear it from you. And I think that most people do find their passion. Most do. And, you know, others talk about regretting it. But I don't think you can avoid what your real passion is. It comes to you when you're young. If you get no real direct passion that you know of, and where am I in this world? What do I even care about? That's sort of sad. But even if all you care about is watching baseball games, that's still a passion.
Absolutely,
find
it
a
is.
Way.
Steve, thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure.